From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, U of M nurses vote to authorize a strike.
Over 4,000 people voted to give authorization for the bargaining team to call for up to a three-day work stoppage.
A miserable weekend for Big Ten football.
Seven Big Ten teams lost, more than half because Michigan State had the weekend off. So 7 out of 13 teams lost to teams they're supposed to crush.
There's a new film about Detroit's Gilda Radner. We talk with her brother, Michael.
She had an effect on people. You fell in love with her. There was just something real and lovable, and she just made people happy.
Writer Lillian Lee weaves a story from her time working at a Chinese restaurant.
One of the waiters who had been there for the longest time turned to me and said, you know, working here, it's been like a cage over my heart.
Those stories and more today for you on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Nurses at the University of Michigan have voted to authorize a potential strike to protest what they call ongoing and continuous violations of their workplace rights. The University of Michigan Professional Nurses Council says a large majority of the RNs at Michigan Medicine voted in favor of a three-day work stoppage at U of M. Katie Oppenheim is chair of this council. Katie, how many nurses voted yes?
Over 4,000 people voted to give authorization for the bargaining team to call for up to a three-day work stoppage related to unfair labor practice charges if we find that becomes necessary at some time in the future.
So this basically gives you that rather important trump card to put down into the bargaining process.
Yes.
Now, are there non-union nurses on staff at Michigan Medicine?
Yes, just managers and people who don't work in direct nursing jobs but are nurses. But all the people that take care of the patients and have anything to do with that are represented by the University of Michigan Professional Nurse Council and Michigan Nurses Association.
So what are the main grievances, Katie?
So the main issue, the reason why we felt the need to take this vote was that this employer has refused to bargain. And nurses, we've been ready and willing to bargain with them 7 days a week for months now. And we filed these charges basically because the employer has been unwilling to, in the legal term, bargain in good faith, which just really means sort of the level of respect that the parties show for each other to sit down and hammer out the issues at hand.
And when you say filing charges, you're talking about filing charges against the university with Michigan's
Correct.
Employment filing Relations
with
Commission.
The Michigan Employment Relations Commission, yes.
Okay. And then continuing, what are the other complaints?
The first one has to do with bargaining in bad faith, where July 2nd, basically up until July 1st, which is when the contract expired on June 30th, we were discussing issues, making some movement, getting some tentative agreements, but then things pretty much halted and we haven't made any movement since then. On July 2nd, Dr. Spollinger, the president of the health system, sent out an email guaranteeing the staffing would remain the same. So we asked for that to go into writing, and the employer refused. Basically, sending out a message in writing to thousands of people, nurses and other employees, and then refusing to write it down in a way that makes it official. In addition, there's a charge related to a work group of advanced practice nurses in our institution who have summarily been told to basically work more hours for the same pay. Over the course of a year, they would work about a week more than they work now for no extra pay. And then the third one has to do with freedom of speech. We filed also a First Amendment lawsuit in court last week related to our members' inability to, in this case, wear certain clothing, but really it has to do with working in a public setting to speak out with what they believe. At the same time, the employer does allow people to wear a variety of different statements on their clothing.
So you've got this permission from the membership, enough of the membership, to be able to call up to a three-day work stoppage. Do you have any idea when that might happen?
No, we don't. But we want to send a message to the employer that we are ready and willing to sit down and really bargain anytime. Hopefully, they see this as a point in time that is one that they should take a pause and say, you know, we're serious. We're not going to back down, and that our patients are and their families are critical to us, and that we need to have the resources to take care of them, and that when you say you're going to do something, we expect you to do it. And at the minimum, we expect you to talk about the ramifications of all the things that we've brought to the table. That's the key. So we don't know exactly when this will happen. We hope that we can sit down and bargain anytime. We're ready to do it.
And what do you most need to see from the employer to keep this walkout from happening?
A sincere effort to sit down and get a deal. So that would mean, you know, sort of saying we're gonna sit down and we are gonna talk about these issues that we've said we're not gonna talk about, because they're important issues and they're subjects that must be talked about in these negotiations. So, you know, it's say how they're going to respond. But again, we are ready to talk at any time, and hopefully that will happen sooner than later.
Katie Oppenheim, University of Michigan Professional Nurses Council, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
And we received a statement from Michigan Medicine spokesperson that reads in part, and I quote, "We are disappointed that our UMPNC nurses have voted to approve a strike. We have been bargaining in good faith since January and have offered a competitive package. Because it is illegal for public employees to strike, Michigan Medicine will take legal action to avoid a strike. We remain ready to continue bargaining with the UMPNC and are eager to resolve the contract negotiations." You can read Michigan Medicine's entire statement at michiganradio.org. And now an update on a criminal case in Detroit. Earlier this year, a young mother was convicted for pointing her gun at someone in a situation she claimed was self-defense, and she got a mandatory 2-year prison sentence. The story received some national attention, largely because Suwatu Salama Ra was pregnant at time of the incident, and because it appeared that the stand your ground law was not applied in her case, and now she's appealing her conviction. Sarah Swick has been following the story, and she's with us now. Sarah, remind us just what this case is all about.
Well, this case originated in a dispute or a fight between two teenage girls, actually, and one of those girls was the niece of Suwatu Salama Ra. Apparently, the other young woman in this case, who was the daughter of someone who was known to the family, the two girls got into a fight at school. One of the young ladies, they apparently made up after this fight, and then the other young girl came to stay with Ra's niece at her family home, her mother's home in Detroit in, I believe, July of 2017. And this upset the family because there was still some tension between the families over this. So the girl's mother, whose name was Chanel Harvey, was called to come and pick up her daughter. Apparently, a dispute ensued after that in which Suwatu Salama Ra says that Miss Harvey used her vehicle as a weapon and rammed into her car, which had her 2-year-old daughter playing in it at the time, and then tried to run over her mother, and that she pulled her unloaded gun on them in self-defense. Now, Miss Harvey presented a different version of the story, claimed she hit the car accidentally and that she was not trying to run anyone over, and she filed a complaint against Miss Ra, and Miss Ra was the one who ended up sentenced to 2 years for felonious assault and a weapons charge.
And now she's appealing that conviction. So what is her attorney arguing?
So there's actually about a half dozen legal issues in this appeal, but the two sort of ones at the forefront center on some issues that the defense, Ms. Ra's attorney, claims the judge made, some errors that the judge made during the trial. This is Wade Fink, Suwatu's attorney.
He made so many errors in this case, in this trial, that it was hard as an appellate lawyer to pick which issues I was going to bring up. I mean, that's just how riddled with error and unfair this trial was.
So help us understand, what are the major errors the attorney is citing in this appeal?
So the testimony at trial, and that was accepted into the record and I don't believe was ever challenged, was that Ms. Ra's gun was unloaded. So her attorney is saying here that the judge should have instructed the jury that she was using non-deadly force rather than deadly force when she pointed the gun at Miss Harvey, saying she was trying to get her to go away and stop using her car as a weapon. Now, the situations in which you're allowed to use non-deadly force rather than deadly force under Michigan law are much broader. To use deadly force, you have to be in immediate fear of your life or of great bodily harm. But the judge instructed the jury that they could only consider that she had used deadly force, and they convicted her on that basis. Now, Ms. Ra's attorney, Wade Fink, says that was an improper jury instruction and that that was one of the major errors that the judge made in this case.
So the question becomes, was it reasonable for Miss Ra with a 2-year-old child in the front seat of her car, perceiving Miss Harvey, a person on felony probation for felonious assault, perceiving her to be ramming her car towards her 2-year-old child and her mother, is it reasonable to deter that person with an unloaded gun?
So Mr. Fink there actually brings up one of the second big issues that is the basis for appeal here, which is that Chanel Harvey was on probation for her third felony when this incident occurred, but the jury never heard about that because the judge instructed that her past convictions not be entered into the evidence. But Mr. Fink, her lawyer, says that that was an error, again, on the judge's part because it gave Ms. Harvey potential motivation to lie about how everything went down here because she was on probation at the time. So that's another one of the major issues that's going to be considered on appeal.
So, Sarah, how likely is this appeal to succeed? What are you hearing?
It's very hard to overturn jury verdicts. We don't know, or at least I don't know exactly, you know, percentage-wise what the odds are, but from what I hear from appellate lawyers, it's in the single digits of cases of appeals that challenge jury verdicts that actually succeed. So it's a long shot in that sense, but Mr. Fink says that Ms. Ra, he thinks, has a very strong appeal, and it looks, at least to a layperson, like there are at least a couple issues here raised about what went on at trial that seem to have some legal merit.
And I know you've spoken with Sawatu Salama Ra's family. What are they saying?
Well, I spoke to her mom, Rhonda Anderson, and she says, again, we need to remember that Sawatu was pregnant when she went to prison. So she gave birth to her second child. In a hospital, but she was in custody. Her family was not allowed to be there. She was separated from the baby after 48 hours and sent back to prison, and that's when the family got to pick the baby up. Fortunately, both her and her son came through the delivery safely, and he's now apparently a healthy baby boy. But just that experience and the, you know, just the sort of constant emotional roller coaster of going through the legal process and now the appeals process, Rhonda Anderson, her mom, says has been very difficult.
It is so tense. It is not comfortable at all. Each day, each hour of the day is difficult because you're waiting to get a call and say, oh, yes, she can come home.
What is the timeline, Sarah?
Well, in addition to actually appealing her conviction, they're also seeking an appeals bond for her. That means that she would be, if granted, allowed out on bond while the appeal is proceeding. So they're apparently Mr. Fink is trying to work out a deal with the Wayne County Prosecutor's Office to perhaps get their recommendation for that. We'll see if that actually happens, but we should know about that fairly soon. The appeal itself could go on possibly 4 months.
Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick. Sarah, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Time for sports as we say hello to Michigan Radio sports commentator John U. Bacon. So the Lions headed west to play the 49ers, coming on the heels of that disastrous season opener, and they lost 30-27. Any improvement over that first weekend's drubbing?
Well, yeah, it wasn't a drubbing, I guess you could say. They fought back on foreign turf. They showed some fight there at the end. Stafford looked very good in the second half, fourth quarter especially.
A little rocky in the first.
Very rocky in the first. And the question is, this sounds pathetic to ask about a 2-game coach. And you know me on this show, I'm always for patience.
Yes.
Stay calm. It takes a while to build anything good and so on. You have to ask the honest question, has Patricia lost his team or not? Now, they fought back. That's a good sign. But it is not what people expected. This team was 9-7 last year. They weren't bad. And they're losing teams. The Jets had 5 wins last year, and the Niners had 6 wins last year, and you're losing to these teams.
Okay. So how much of a learning curve should fans expect?
More than 2 games, apparently. The season's going to play out. Look, he'll get his 2 or 3 years, and he should. But I can't recall a more ignoble debut on and off the field, frankly, than this guy's had.
Speaking of ignoble, it was a rather memorable weekend for the Tigers as they lost 15-0 Saturday night in Cleveland and, of course, helped the Indians right into clinching the division. I know that Cleveland rested some players Sunday, and they probably didn't even care that they lost 6-4 to the Tigers.
They did not.
They did not. Is there anything Tigers fans can take hope in right now?
If they fire Al Avila, the general manager. Speaking of guys in over their head, Patricia, we don't know. Yeah. And Bob Quinn is a very serious GM for the Lions. Patricia's got a good record. Al Avila's got nothing on his side other than a lot of last-place finishes. taken over from Dave Dombrowski, whom the Tigers basically fired. Mm-hmm. He had won four straight division titles with Detroit, had a bad season there at the end. He goes right to Boston, where they were dead last in 2015, and then they've been first and first, and right now they've got by far the best record in baseball with 103 victories. Oof. So your solution, you fired.
All right. Over to the Red Wings, the end of the Zetterberg era as Henrik Zetterberg retires. That chronic bad back ends his career. When you look past all the stats like the 1,082 games and 40 points away from 1,000, he got the Stanley Cup. He's got an Olympic gold medal. But what did this man bring to the Red Wings?
Pure class. Pure class, a great captain. You cannot find anybody in the Red Wings organization or in the NHL who has nothing but consummate respect for this guy. In a violent game, that is not a given. That is a real rarity. Who else in that category? Steve Yzerman and Nicklas Lidström, the captains before him. The Red Wings fans have been spoiled with 32 years of phenomenal captains, only three, and he's right up there with those guys.
Who would you bet to succeed him as captain?
Hard to say, which is testament to how rare this is to have that many great captains in a row, of course. Nicklas Cronwall is the current assistant captain, but he's about to retire.
Yeah.
So he's probably not going to be it. Justin Abdicator has been an assistant captain for a few years. Mm-hmm. He could well be the captain. Dylan Larkin might be also an assistant captain this year. They're talking about going with three assistant captains, or two, perhaps, and that way let them duke it out, if you will. But again, it shows you how the exception proves the rule, how spoiled Wings fans have been. Man, Zetterberg was drafted at 210th by the Red Wings, and the guy was an underdog. He was highly competitive. He has won the World Cup gold, Olympic gold, Stanley Cup, a rare Triple Crown winner. I'm going to miss him.
Yeah, I think a lot of fans will. And, of course, people were very excited at Steve Yzerman's announcement. He was stepping down as GM of Tampa Bay. A lot of buzz on social media. So hard to say what might come from that.
If I had a bet right now, I do think Yzerman might come back to Detroit next year.
Oh, we'll see what happens. Let's talk college football. Big Ten had a lousy weekend. How bad was it?
The worst I can remember. Seven Big Ten teams lost, more than half because Michigan State had the weekend off. So 7 out of 13 teams lost to teams they're supposed to crush. Ooh. Northwestern lost to Akron. Nebraska lost to Troy. Not Troy and Athens, no.
So what kind of writing on the wall do you see as you look down to college football playoff time?
It's going to be a real problem for Ohio State. Ohio State is the one it affects because they're the one team right now that's got a really good chance to get to the Final Four. And to get there, though, you not only have to have zero or one loss max, you need a strong strength of schedule. And with the Big Ten the way it is right now, they're not going to get it. So it's up to them and the Big Ten.
Now, Michigan polished off SMU, as you predicted, and they will be hosting Nebraska next weekend. So what are your thoughts?
Watch out. Nebraska's 0-2 under first-year coach Scott Frost, whose team last year, Central Florida, was undefeated. Mm-hmm. So this guy can coach, and he's a Nebraska legend like Harbaugh is at Michigan. And you don't want to face a team that's 0-2 looking for its first game. Your team tends to underestimate them, and they come in with nothing to lose. And if you beat them, you get nothing. And if you lose to them, it's a disaster. So it's like fighting a 15-year-old boy.
And what about Michigan
Doesn't
State
work.
Going to Indiana next Saturday to kick off its Big Ten play?
They'll beat them. They'll get it on track. It's down to the running game and the offensive line of the 2 weak spots right now. D'Antonio always has strong O-lines and running games. They'll get it together.
All right. We should also say one quick hat tip to Western Michigan beating Delaware State 68-0. That's kind of an ouch if you're a Hornets fan.
It is. I don't know how many Hornets fans there are based on this, but they've got one heck of a band, I can tell you that.
And finally, happy birthday to your little Teddy, 3 years old. What do you hope for him in sports as he grows up?
Great question. What I got myself. I want to be the best player on the team sometimes and the worst other times. Have great coaches, have bad coaches, and learn how to handle it all. And I hope he's a sports fan so we can talk about sports the way my dad and I do.
Wonderful. Well, happy birthday, Teddy, Michigan Radio Sports commentator, John Eubanks. Thank you, John.
Thank you.
Chinese restaurants are about as familiar as McDonald's and Burger King. Most of us don't even have to think twice about what we want on the Americanized menu, consisting of staples such as sweet and sour pork, chow mein, and General Tso's chicken. Often overlooked, though, are the stories behind the families that make these Chinese restaurants run. And that's what Michigan writer Lillian Lee brings us in her debut novel, Number One Chinese Restaurant, a book that's attracting national attention. Lillian Lee graduated from the University of Michigan Helen Zell Writers Program in 2015, and Number One Chinese Restaurant is her debut novel. Lillian, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
And how does it feel for a writer to get a nice big review for her first big book from the New York Times book section? I opened up my paper that Sunday in July, and there was your name even on the cover of the Sunday section.
It was absolutely surreal. I don't think I had sort of the emotions to really deal with it. And so actually, I think I got excited just watching other people get excited for me, if that makes sense.
It was a nice way to say, hey, I've arrived. So Number One Chinese Restaurant tells us the story of the owners and the workers at this family-run Beijing Duck House in Rockville, Maryland. How do you describe just what this novel is?
I think that what I've been sort of saying is that, you know, it looks at basically an upscale Peking duck restaurant outside D.C., and it looks at the lives of the family that owns this restaurant, the Hans, as well as their longtime employees. And what happens when one summer a tragedy befalls this place and this working family no longer has both a business or really a second home to go back to anymore.
So it's certainly family dramas and a lot of complicated family relationships. As you say, there's the family that owns the Duck House, the Han family, and there's the family of workers. And with both of these families, you have the Chinese-born older folks and then on down to that third generation
right.
of the American-born teens. What kind of tensions and issues do you show us between those folks who immigrated to the U.S. from China and those who were born here in this country?
You know, I think that a lot of the novels that I read that do deal with that kind of immigrant and multi-generational narrative do tend to fixate on language barriers and cultural differences. And I think that's definitely there in the book. But I wanted to look at something more, just sort of what it looks like when a person's value system shifts because of what is capable for them in this lifetime. So when you look at that first generation that comes over, what's possible in their lifetime, it's already amazing that they're able to have a building that they own, a restaurant that, you know, people in the community love. But that next generation, they are born into a slightly different position of privilege, really. And suddenly they're thinking, I can get more. And they're looking at what their parents did, and they're thinking, why do you have so little? And so that's something that I really wanted to play with generation after generation, is that sort of looking askance at the people before.
And then even the children of that second generation are looking, going, I don't know if I want that.
Right, exactly.
And I think what's so good about the way you spell all of this out and weave this story, Lillian, is you don't have to be Chinese American, you don't have to be Asian American to get it, because I think in so many families, those kinds of tensions exist.
Right, right. We're all looking down on our elders. And we should be giving them some respect.
Well, caught in the middle of this, I want to talk about Jimmy and Johnny, and they're the two brothers who run the Duck House. And
yes.
Jimmy wants to get out from under the restaurant that his immigrant father founded. So he's the one going, why didn't you have more?
Right.
He wants his own place, which sets up tensions with his brother. So what's Johnny's want? What does he want out of this?
So the funny thing about Johnny is that he is so similar to Jimmy. He also is looking down at his father, but because he sees himself as a really upstanding guy, his way of spinning his sort of disdain is thinking, I really want to burnish my father's legacy. I want to make his legacy what he wanted. And what he really is saying is, I want to make this restaurant what I want. So he essentially wants to build up the Duck House and make it a kind of, you know, big DC cultural center, whereas Jimmy just sort of wants to like throw it away, start over. But really, their kind of desires are twinned.
And then here's their, because father has passed away, so father is not on the scene. Mm-hmm. And talk about their mother.
Feng Fei. So I know that she is a lot of readers' favorite characters. She's definitely one of mine as well. And what's fascinating about her is that, you know, her children have obviously thought that she is gone. She is basically entombed in the mansion that, you know, Bobby has left her. And they're assuming that she's kind of out of the picture. But, you know, what happens is that you can't sleep on your ancestors, especially if they're still alive.
because they will come back with a vengeance. And that's exactly what she does.
Now, you worked at a Chinese restaurant for, a short while?
Very short. I would say not even a month.
Okay.
Because it was exactly 4 weeks.
And not that she was counting or anything. What was that experience like for you?
It was incredibly challenging, but it wasn't actually until I quit that I realized what was challenging about it.
And what was that?
So I assumed it was the physical aches and pains, but actually I think it was the emotional, you know, challenge of essentially working in a Chinese restaurant with a Chinese face, because what often happens is that your customers end up seeing you not as a human being, but almost more like the decoration of the place.
Like a prop.
A piece of furniture. Yes, exactly, a prop.
Yes.
And so being in that kind of environment 6 days a week, 12 hours a day, you're not seeing your family or your friends because you're exhausted on your day off, you know, that kind of toll was really what was, I think, driving me into the walk-in fridge every day to, you know, have a little cry. When I told all of my coworkers, who had been really kind and supportive the entire time, they all kind of clustered around me and started telling me basically how proud they were of me for leaving. And one of the waiters who had been there for the longest time and was one of the most cheerful waiters I saw, he kind of took off that cheerful mask and turned to me and said, you know, working here, it's been like a cage over my heart. And I think those words really are the ones that haunted me until I started writing this novel down.
And now I'm going to ask you if you'd read us a passage from your book. And this centers on the Duck House's manager, Nan, who is one of my favorite characters. And this gives us a sense of the way she skillfully runs the place.
The irony was that Nan was probably the best manager the Duck House had ever seen. She had a way of coddling the most belligerent customers, never resorting to throwing half-off coupons on the problem, Johnny's favorite move, or indiscriminately punishing the waitstaff with a week of forced unpaid leave, as Jimmy liked to do. She used her nose for conflict to head off complaints, steering easily chilled matrons away from the air conditioning vents, handling toddlers' balls of dough to play with and gum on, passing out free punch to the dining room she knew the restaurant would receive no negative reviews for Uncle Pong's outburst earlier. When her ladle hit the bottom of the pitcher, she checked the room for signs of tension. Not the customers this time, but the waiters. It was impossible to tell. They were professionals on the floor, their faces rubbed smooth of emotion. Though Ah Bing's back was to her, Nan knew he looked entirely different than before. He would have pushed his glasses up to pinch the top of his nose, which turned his squint feline and friendly. With this simple push, Ah Bing morphed into the happy, playful waiter she saw out on the floor. He even sounded different, his English boyish and simple, lacking the sharp slyness that textured his Chinese. The transformation was stark and immediate and pure fantasy. Yet Nan still believed that this motion of shifting his glasses up his nose was what reminded Ah Bing of who he was allowed to be and when. Every waiter had a trick. The quartet of little girls at one of his tables cheered as he approached, and he cheered right back.
That is Lillian Lee reading from her debut novel, Number One Chinese Restaurant. What was the thought process you had that helped you as you shaped this story?
As I mentioned, I was crying a lot at this job. Nobody else was in that walk-in fridge with me. And so I had to really consider, okay, so I couldn't last 4 weeks in that environment. All of my coworkers have for years, for decades. And so, you know, what does a person do to actually make that environment not just livable, but actually thrivable, right? And at the same time, what does that environment end up doing to that person's personality over time? What are they willing to do in order to have connection and dignity and love inside of a restaurant space? And what are they willing to give up in their outside lives?
And to the point of folks that have spent decades doing this very, very hard, emotionally hard and physically hard work, because that is such a memorable line about having to have a cage over your heart. What did you want to say through this book about immigrants finding their place in the U.S.?
I think that for a while I was saying to anyone who asked what a reader would get out of this novel that I wanted them to be able to learn something new about the Chinese waiters at their Chinese restaurant. But then I realized that wasn't actually the point, because I have never once wondered whether or not the Chinese waiters in my restaurant were human or what they were thinking about. And in fact, what is more surprising is that so many people do have that response. And so, in fact, what I wanted people to leave after reading this book is actually with a changed idea of their own responses and their own reactions to Chinese waiters in a Chinese restaurant. So that's my biggest hope, is that people really change something about their own perspective rather than thinking that their perspective on these characters has shifted.
So what's next? What do you want to write about next?
You know, I thank Michigan a lot for taking me away from my hometown, because I think it's really
true. Rockville.
Of Rockville, yes. Because you just can't really see your hometown until you leave it. And so I had no idea how large the Asian American population is there. I think it's 1 in 3 in North Potomac, which is, you know, where I spent a lot of years. And what does that kind of bubble do to a community that otherwise is marginalized in America? And so I think whatever my next project is, it's going to be really centered on that kind of bubble and what it means to live inside a bubble.
Lillian Lee will be signing her book, Number One Chinese Restaurant, on September 20th from 7 until 9 p.m. at Nicholas Bookstore in Ann Arbor. And it's a very enjoyable read. And you really do a beautiful job of getting subtle things that happen between characters. And so, bravo you.
Thank you. And thank you for reading. I know how busy you are.
Still ahead, a new movie about the legendary comedian Gilda Radner, told through her own diaries and recordings.
When I think back on my life, I always felt that my comedy was just to make things be all right.
That is in 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The association that represents Michigan's 15 public universities has kicked off a four-year marketing campaign focusing on the benefits of a four-year degree. It's aimed at high school seniors and parents. Here to talk about the Make a Difference campaign is Dan Hurley, the CEO of the Michigan Association of State Universities. Dan, what's the reason for launching this campaign now?
Partially, if you look at the state's demographics trends, we have a declining pipeline of high school graduates. That's one. And we know that we need to have a educated, highly skilled workforce moving forward if the state overall is going to have a very strong economy. And unfortunately, we've actually had a decreasing college participation rate in recent years. Part of that might be a strong economy, but we are below average in that category. So we want to increase college enrollment to help more people achieve their dreams, have better job security, and help the state overall in terms of an economic perspective.
Dan, what about the rising cost of a college degree? Certainly we've seen recent college graduates just facing record levels of student debt. So what's the value proposition for young people and their parents to go into such debt, especially when wages don't seem to be keeping up with those skyrocketing costs of a degree?
There is actually very significant labor market demand for a college degree right now. Huge demand, a lot of job security in Michigan in a decade ahead. The main message point that we're trying to drive home in this statewide campaign is that on average, individuals that attend a Michigan public university receive a 40% discount rate. And they pay 40% less when scholarships and financial aid are taken into consideration. So the number one action step, the call to action for this campaign, is to encourage high school students, seniors specifically, and their parents to fill out the free application for federal student aid, known as the FAFSA. And those can be filled out beginning October 1. We certainly encourage students to fill those out sooner rather than later. So in the fall is better than in the winter months. And that FAFSA form can be the key to unlocking a significant amount of federal student aid, and then state grant programs and institutions and all the financial aid that they provide also utilize that form. So bottom line is, yes, we hear headlines on tuition price increases, but when you factor in all of the student aid that is out there, not including student loans, that's separate, college really is affordable. And even for those that do have student debt, you should know it's very interesting. 40% of the graduates of Michigan's 15 public universities graduate with no student debt. those that do, with a degree in hand, they certainly will have a much higher earnings potential and job security over the course of their careers and should have no problem paying that student debt back.
Dan, we've seen politicians, in fact, most notably Governor Snyder, emphasizing the value of skilled trades for years. We hear it from business groups, politicians, and pushing the skilled trades as an alternative to a four-year degree. What's your response to that?
Well, this campaign is really focused on bolstering the four-year college degree attainment in the state, but I will say we need more education at all levels. But when you look at the state's labor market forecast through 2026, looking at the top 50 high-wage, high-demand careers, fully 35 of those 50 professions require minimally a four-year college degree. That's just an interesting data point to kind of dispel the myth that a four-year degree specifically is not in high demand.
Dan, one other common argument about the rising cost of college degrees is the growth of administrative layers, the salaries for jobs that don't have much to do with directly educating students. How can universities themselves do a better job at lowering costs and being more attractive to prospective students?
So it's a good question, and I would make the argument that the generic administrator, you know, they're not in the classroom directly, but they ultimately have a very strong support role regarding student services or academic services or maybe helping on the advancement side of things, trying to raise some dollars to help with scholarships and grant aid. When you look at the spending at the 15 public universities in Michigan, between 2000 and 2016, factor in inflation, that spending went up actually 2.3% over that entire 16-year period when you look at it through the, a per-student basis. And so, you know, what has really happened here with the rising tuition prices is a state-to-student cost shift in who pays for a college education. And I will say the universities have not simply been passing the buck. When the state several years back made some very, very dramatic cuts to higher education, recognizing the importance of access and affordability, but also maintaining quality, they have made a tremendous amount of changes administratively, eliminating programs, and we're trying to do everything they can kind of in the back of the house, the business side of the enterprise, you know, in trying to protect the academic core. So we'll say Michigan's public universities have a national and global reputation for high-quality academic programs, and so they're wanting to maintain that at the same time, you know, limit administrative cost increases.
Dan, more universities are offering more online degree programs. Is that the future of higher ed in your view?
I don't believe it is. I think the growth in online, it continues to grow those programs, but that program growth is moderated. You know, you don't hear too many people saying that's going to be the jewel, that's what needs to happen. I think maybe the sweet spot is a combination for students that is partially on campus and then partially online. Those hybrid courses that some of them have shown to actually increase, ultimately, student learning outcomes, which is really important. But the experience that undergraduates get when they enter a college campus, live on it, and are engaged in all of the activities there and meeting people from all over the world, that is remarkably important to the development of individuals, their careers, their network. And I think that that model is going to stay around for a while.
The Make a Difference campaign from the Michigan Association of State Universities. We've been talking to its CEO, Dan Hurley. Dan, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
October 11th, 1975, NBC premiered a new live comedy show called Saturday Night, and America discovered Gilda Radner. The Detroiter was a member of the original cast, dubbed the Not Ready for Primetime Players. And it didn't take long for America to fall in love with Gilda. And when ovarian cancer took her life in 1989, when she was just 42, it felt like losing a dear friend. Now there's a chance to discover Gilda Radner in a special way, her own voice, her own words, home movies, all presented in the film Love, Gilda, directed by Lisa Dapolito. It's opening at select theaters this coming Friday. And here with us now is producer Meryl Goldsmith. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And it's a pleasure to welcome Gilda's brother, Michael Radner. It's such a pleasure to have you with us, Michael.
Thank you. Gilda got me into one more thing that without her, you wouldn't be talking to me. So I'm happy to be here.
We're glad you're with us. Meryl, this is so not the typical documentary where there's someone doing a voiceover narration about the story. You've got Gilda. We hear her voice. We hear the words she'd written in her journal. So where did this treasure trove of source material come from?
It actually came from Michael, from his attic. I know Lisa, when she first started to look into doing a documentary about Gilda, she was put immediately in contact with Michael. And Michael can tell you about when they finally went in and cracked open the Gilda archives, which it had tons and tons of material we were able to use.
Michael, why was this the project you were willing to share so much with, both in terms of your memories of your sister, but especially all of this source material?
Well, what happened was Lisa had started out, she had been doing volunteer work, making volunteer videos for Gilda's Club in New York City, where she lives. And she was starting to make a video about how the members of Gilda's Club and Gilda connected. And so she came into town and she was talking to me. And I said, by the way, I've got all this stuff that's been piled up here of Gilda's that I had not really spent any time going through. And she took a look and that changed everything. Suddenly the movie expanded and she realized I had journals and tapes and all sorts of things. And in talking to Lisa and knowing her, I trusted her. And I let her go through all these things, and she realized there was a movie there, and there was a movie where Gilda could tell her own story, which was important, as opposed to somebody else telling her story.
Yeah, it's tremendously powerful to hear her words. I know you take us, Meryl, in the film through Gilda's girlhood in Detroit, and we see how that she discovers theater in high school at University Liggett when it was still in Detroit, and then went to the University of Michigan as a theater major, but she didn't graduate.
Yeah, no, she didn't graduate. She was really close. She followed a guy to Toronto and ended up, that's actually where she launched her career, so it worked out anyways. But I'm a university alum, and I know we're still proud of Gilda anyways, even though she didn't graduate. So.
and going to Toronto, as we see in Love, Gilda, you're right. It led to her first professional theater gig and then on to New York after John Belushi invited her to be the girl for the National Lampoon Radio Hour, and then Lorne Michaels choosing her for that first cast of Saturday Night.
Hi, I'm Gilda Radner. And, okay, now.
I found that my comfort in live television was laughter, that I can do almost anything if people are laughing. That's what hugs me and holds me and gets things out of me.
Live from New York, it's Saturday Night!
Michael, when did it hit her that she was famous, she was a celebrity, and how did that affect her?
Well, it affected her at some point. She realized that if she wanted to get a package of chewing gum, she couldn't go to the store by herself because people would be stopping her and honking at her and everything else. So stardom has its advantages and disadvantages, but it didn't really change her in terms of her personality. She was basically a good, nice person around NBC. She treated the guy who swept the floor as well as she treated the president of the corporation. I mean, that was the kind of person she was.
And I know, Meryl, when we talk about the kind of toll doing Saturday Night took on Gilda, your film lets us hear her take on her struggles with an eating disorder and her sheer exhaustion. What struck you most about the way that she tackled those problems?
I didn't realize, I mean, just how truly courageous she was. And just using humor with all of the issues that she faced, she took humor and used it as a defense to all the tough things that happened to us in life, and she really sets the example of how people should handle things. And so I was just taken back at what a strong person she was. And when we screen the film around the country, people come up to us after and just gush to us not only about Gilda, but how influential she was on their lives as either cancer survivors or fighters or actors and comedians. And I think everyone can relate to not only how well she did, but also the inner struggles and how she was able to face those two. It's just
such an inspiration.
And there is certainly a love story in this, Michael, and we see how Gilda met Gene Wilder while shooting the 1982 film Hanky Panky, and she married him in 1984. What do you think it was about Gene that just it seemed to strike her like a lightning bolt?
Well, Gilda, as she admits, what was important to her, she was looking for love. And I think when she met Gene, suddenly everything fell into place. He was, you know, if she'd made a list of what she was looking for to be in love, he met all those qualifications. Plus, he was really a nice man. I mean, my relationship with him was very good. He was a calm, you know, as opposed to his frenetic personalities in his roles and things like that. If you met him, you would have thought he was a college philosophy professor. He was a really kind, nice man. And the most important thing I can say about him is he took such good care of Gilda while she was sick. That was so important to me, being far away from her while she was in California or even in Connecticut. It was reassuring to know that this wonderful man was taking such good care of my sister.
And seeing the home films, the very intimate home films shot in the hospital room of him embracing her, I get goosebumps now even just thinking of having seen that. What a connection. And Meryl, you show us in the film how Gilda was able to find the ability to be funny in the face of a very unfunny disease. It certainly didn't happen right away.
I kept thinking there must be a purpose to this somewhere, that a comedian who does, you know, Roseanne, Rosanna, Dana, and all this stupid stuff gets the most unfunny thing in the world. How am I going to get people to laugh about it, to be able to speak the words, to be able to not be afraid to be treated for it?
She said, you know something? My jokes are my only weapon against this f-.
Tell us about the solace she found at the wellness community.
Oh, that was just wonderful for her. And you could just see in the film what an important place it was for her, because I think for people who have cancer, I'm sure it feels like you're alone. And when she walked through those doors, she no longer felt that way. And she felt she had a community of friends who she could laugh with and talk with and just forget about cancer and have a place to really be a second home. And once after she passed away, you know, Gene and Joanna both started Gilda's Club, which had a similar mission, which was a place where people could go. People with cancer, their family, their friends can go and have a community and support system. So that's what she found with the Wellness Center, and that's what has continued with Gilda's Club.
And Gilda's been gone since 1989. That's nearly 30 years, but boy, not forgotten. I think one of the most touching parts of the film is seeing today's very, very hot comedians, Amy Poehler and Melissa McCarthy and Cecily Strong and Bill Hader, when they're holding Gilda's journal so reverently and emotionally reading her words aloud, or just say her name. We saw this here at the office. People melt. Michael, why do you think Gilda still matters so much to people 3 decades after she died?
Well, for one thing, people thought she was very funny, but also she had an effect on people. You fell in love with her. There was just something real and lovable, and she just made people happy. And, you know, just going back a little bit with first Gilda experiencing support groups at the wellness community, and then Gilda's Club getting started, where Joanna Bull and Jean took all the best things from the wellness community and built in even more at Gilda's Club. And as you know, there's a Gilda's Club here in Metro Detroit and one in Grand Rapids. And they're just wonderful places. When I am someplace that involves Gilda, people come up to me and tell me how important Gilda's Club has been to them. This is part of Gilda's legacy. And they go on and on about how it's changed their lives and really an important part of their life and how it's helped them deal with cancer, them, their families, their friends. So I got to put the pitch in. Gilda's Clubs are there. Everything is free. They need support, and I want people to support them year-round because they do make a difference in people's lives, and you never know when you're going to be one or someone you care about is going to need that kind of support.
And just to reiterate, we're lucky enough to have two in Michigan, as you say, the one in West Michigan in Lowell, and then the one in Royal Oak for covering Southeast Michigan. And Love Gilda will open this Friday in select theaters. And we have been talking with producer Meryl Goldsmith and Gilda's brother, Michael. And as you say, she dragged you into something else, and we are so glad she did. We were so glad to have you with us, Michael. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you. Pleasure being with you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Lindsay Scullin and engineered by Bob Scon. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, April Van Buren, Sam Corey, Joey Horan, and Sarah Leeson. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.